So it's a real mix of the kind of the everyday and the just the basic informational and the kind of this ephemeral sweet stuff about who we are as humans.
That's Simon Rogers, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Simon Rogers is Google's data editor, leading a team of data journalists, analysts, and visualizers to tell stories with Google's data. He joins us to talk about what we ask Google, a surprisingly hopeful history of humankind. Simon, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about your job there at Google and how it led to this book.
So my title is data editor, which is really a kind of hangover from my older days when I used to work in the Guardian newsroom back in the UK. And basically, it's about telling stories with data. So I grew up, I didn't particularly like maths, but I somehow got into this way of using numbers to kind of to enhance stories and kind of make them accessible for people. And right now I work with the world's biggest publicly accessible data set, which is called Google Trends. And it's a sample of all Google searches, and it's anonymized and aggregated and so on, so that we can really see how the world is searching. And anybody can go on and do this, but I guess this is what I do every day. So we work on big projects, such as something called Year in Search, which is a kind of roundup of the end of the year. And that's really about seeing the world through the ways that we search.
So as you were looking at this data, at what point did you think, you know, I really should write a book about this?
So I'd been wanting to do a book for a while, and this is probably no interest to nobody but me, but I've done a lot about data storytelling. I wanted to do something about that. And I was thinking about the data that I work with every day, and there's something very human about it. And I thought, well, I've not seen anybody really look at the way we search for everyday things, the things that we all share, like, you know, parenting or food or health or grief even. And while I was wondering if it could be a book. And my mum had actually passed away a few months before. And I thought, I'm going to try writing a chapter on grief, because that'll be the hardest one for me to do. And it'll also tell me if this could work. And so I thought, I'm going to start doing this. And I started writing it. And what I saw in the data was that I wasn't the only person searching for the things I was searching for. In those moments, you feel very alone, like you're the only person on earth who's ever gone through this. And of course you're not, but seeing it in the data that not only were other people looking for things that I was looking for around coping with grief and even the logistics of it, also other people were looking for how to help somebody in my position, what's the right thing to say or the right passage to send an email to send or a piece of poetry or whatever it is. And that was really reassuring to me. And it kind of taught me a couple of the themes that really run through the book, one of which was that we may feel lonely, but we're not always alone. It's quite rare, really, because actually the things we go through, millions of other people go through too. And the other thing it showed me was that often we're searching for how to help. And those how to help searches are often really how to help other people. So, and also, it really showed me how we don't know anything about things maybe we should know about, that we're kind of all searching for the basics too. So those became the big themes of the book, and I hadn't gone into it planning to do that at all, but it just kind of came out in the way that the data showed me the way that we search.
And from what you described, then that sort of makes sense about the subtitle of this book, that it's a hopeful history. That as you looked at what people were searching for in aggregate, it actually gave you hope about humanity.
Yeah, I mean, searches for help are higher now than any time in Google Trends history. And we have data going back to 2004. So that's a couple of decades of really this kind of amazing look at the world's brain. And because it's our collected searches, it really gives us a sense of that kind of unifying thing. And often, as I say, we're looking for how to help others. And in recent years, that's been how to help someone with anxiety, say, or depression, because those are phenomena that we all know going on, or it's about how to donate after a crisis when something happens in the world. You know, you don't just watch it on the news. You actually want to take action and do something about it. So seeing that was actually incredibly kind of hopeful and optimistic to me. I didn't set out to write an optimistic book. It definitely came through the data.
Well, let's talk about that data. As you said, you've got over two decades of data, and you list in the book the top searches, at least in the English language, over those 20 years. So tell us a little bit about what has remained constant and been on people's minds for the last couple of decades.
So the thing about this data is obviously it shows the biggest searches, and some of those reflect trends or memes of the moment. So there is one of them is where is Chuck Norris, because there was a big meme about Chuck Norris back in the day. And some of them are very informational, like how do I find my location in maps or what is my IP, things like that. And then some of them are kind of sweet, really, or innocent, like, you know, how do I know if somebody likes me? You know, what is love? How to kiss someone? And then some of them are just really, I don't know how to say, I can't think of another word apart from basic. So how to boil an egg. And I think it reflects, how to boil an egg is more interesting than it sounds, because it kind of reflects the fact that we don't always know things we feel we should know. And the fact that how to boil an egg is consistently one of the top search questions is fascinating to me, because it means that people have searched it repeatedly. So it's not just that we've boiled an egg once, we've boiled an egg many times, and each time we search for how to do it. So it's a real mix of the kind of the everyday and the just the basic informational and the kind of this ephemeral sweet stuff about who we are as humans.
One of the searches that have been consistent over the last 20 years is in regard to time. But then you break that down. It's not just they want to know what time is it, but then, you know, what time is it where? And then what drove those requests? It was just one of the sort of rabbit holes you went into in the book. So tell us a little bit more about time searches.
So time is like searching for the weather. It's one of those things that we all do. And a lot of it is like, what is the time in X place? Partly maybe there's a sporting event or something going on. And sometimes it's also represented in other ways. So when the clocks change, we search for why am I so tired? For instance, our consistent parts of the year. Or there are some things which were just, I laughed out loud. For instance, like how to tell the time drunk, which spikes in London. So... which is no surprise to me, but it's still interesting to see that in the numbers. So it's really one of those things that's kind of like, it is very everyday. It doesn't seem like it would be that relevant, but it actually tells us a lot about our place and our living situation. Like in some places, people search for why is time so slow? Why is time going slowly? And then in New York, they'll search for why is time going so fast? You know, famously, the city that never sleeps. So you can see it kind of reflecting things that are similar, but also things that are variations in different places.
And you noted that, like, if there's a crisis going on in a particular part of the world, people search for what time is it there.
Exactly. And also, there is I guess we call these rhythmic searches, where there are searches that happen at the same time. The same time of day every day. So around 2 a.m., people search the words baby and sleep. Or around 4 a.m., people look for the emergency room. Or, you know, during the day when people are looking for when the gym is open or when can I go and buy coffee. So there are these things that kind of happen every day around the same time. And later at night, they get more kind of metaphysical, like what am I doing with my life? Those kind of searches. And you see that through the year as well, like the top time of year to search for how to play piano is December, as we gear up for the holidays perhaps. So and this time of year it's about planting and promposals, which is a newer search which has spread around the world. It's not just an American thing now, so you'll see that spiking now as we get into the graduation and prom season.
As you point out, in January, there's a lot of searches about those sort of New Year's resolutions, you know, how do I lose weight, et cetera.
And searches for hangover as well after New Year's.
So tell us a bit more about Google Trends, you know, which is what making all of this possible, and how I might use it in my life.
Yeah, so Google Trends is a publicly accessible website. Pretty much everything in the book is from the site because I wanted it to be stuff that people could test. It's a sample of all searches. So it's about a fifth of all searches. And it's anonymized and aggregated. So, and there are what we call differential privacy like guidelines around it. So basically, you can't see any individual searches. What you get instead are these searches that are aggregated by place. So there could be searches for the world, or for the US, or for Kansas. You know, and you can see on the site now, you can go and look at what's trending in Kansas today. So the day that we're chatting down is the Royals versus the Athletics, or King Charles in Congress, or Costco hot dog combo options. It's trendy. So you kind of get a real mix of things that people care about in, say, in Kansas or in anywhere. And it's interesting because it's so I try not to be too kind of like jargony, but in data terms, it's indexed. So what that means is that you can compare a small place to a big place. So you could compare New York City to Wichita. You know, that's definitely possible in the data. And that means that you can start to kind of compare like with like. So you can compare a big place to a small place. And it's, like I say, it's publicly accessible. You can go on there, you can explore 20 years of data, and it shows data from a few minutes ago, and it shows data from 2004. So it's a kind of unique thing. And it's recently started to be used in lots of places. So for instance, you see big kind of world economic organizations using it now. So for instance, the OECD has used it to try and predict weekly GDP, because GDP is an important number, comes out once a quarter. And they've used Google Trends data to try and predict that on a weekly basis. And there's a guy called Hal Varian, who was the chief economist at Google, who's one of the people that set it up. And really, because it's kind of what a guy called John Battelle calls a database of intentions. It's this idea that you search for something often because you want to do something in the future. So it might be you're searching for a vacation. You're not going to go on vacation tomorrow, but you might do it in a month or a few weeks. Or when you're searching for looking for a house, you're not going to buy a house tomorrow, but you might do in a few months. So it's this idea that really, when we search, sometimes it's curiosity. Sometimes it's just because we care about those things in the moment, and that's the ephemeral nature of it. And sometimes it's those important big life decisions that we need to make, and we're planning them out, and we'll start on that early.
And in the book, you talk a bit about sort of what this means. I realize that psychology is beyond the Google Trends, but people will search for things online that they wouldn't say out loud or talk to a friend about, but they will trust Google to give them some answers. So what do you think that kind of says about us as human beings?
I mean, look, there are no dumb questions. I used to work on a science section of a newspaper, and I should know the answer to this question. When my daughter was little, she was doing a school project, and she asked me which was bigger, the galaxy or the universe. So I should have known that. But I didn't. I forgot it or whatever. And I asked it on search. So there is kind of, there's a difference in a way, say, between social media. So social media data is really about you presenting yourself. It's you presenting yourself to the world as in a certain way. Whereas search is a kind of genuine picture of human curiosity. It's the stuff that we really care about, honestly, from one moment to the next. And I think that's what makes it so powerful. It's this incredible kind of insight into who we are. And in my mind, like who we are is kinder and nicer and more generous than perhaps we often give ourselves credit for.
And the comforting thing, you sort of alluded to that at the beginning of the interview, is that you write in the book that even though we're more socially isolated perhaps than ever before, the search reveals that often we're all looking for the same thing. So it makes you feel that you're not quite as alone as you might think you are.
Yeah, we're all part of these kind of communities, honestly. And we tend to think of community as an in-person thing, obviously. But we're kind of part of communities of shared interests around the world. Now, for me, I live in San Francisco. I like trying to get hold of Marmite, which is a very weirdly English thing. And there is a shop here that does it. So I'm probably part of a community, very small community of people that can track down Marmite in different cities, wherever I am. But it's also around things like, I really felt this while I was writing the grief chapter around, you know, people who may be suffering through something or care about something, or, you know, I love the Beatles, so I will, you know, probably be an online expert in the Beatles, but I'm not plainly not the only person looking for them. So I think there is something about that. And, you know, there is a crisis of loneliness, as the former Surgeon General reported. But to me, this is incredibly encouraging, this idea that actually, you know, we share all these common interests with other people, whatever they are. And sometimes you can see very kind of like interesting social changes happening through the data. So for instance, searches for take care of parents have overtaken searches for take care of kids. And, you know, there is a sandwich generation out there of people who are looking after their parents and their children. And to see that reflected in the data, it's not an isolated thing. It's not just happening to me or happening to somebody else, happening to lots of people. So I think it's one of the few data sets that can do that, that can really honestly say who we are.
And another thing you point out in the book, that this is constantly changing, and that what you write about in the book today, 10 years from now, may be very different. But there's lots of fun things. I like to point out that it's not just a serious look. Yeah, there are serious moments in the book, but, you know, if you want to know whether there are more searches for dogs or cats or all sorts of other fun things, you'll find that in the book as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's a real journey, partly for me as well. So, for instance, pets and animals are just such a big part of search. For instance, we search for how to say I love you in dog. It's a real search. And when you look at searches that people put for can you keep as a pet, one of the animals that shows up is a panda. Now, I'm going to tell you, you can't keep a panda as a pet, but it doesn't stop people looking for it. So is that kind of that world of idle curiosity, I guess. And some of it changes over time. So for instance, a few years ago, there was a craze for making slime, which for kids. And there's a concurrent spike in searches for how to get slime out of the carpet.
Makes sense.
So, you know, there is like, we are a strange mix of people. And if you were to guess, say, the top search cuisine in Paris, which is, as we know, the culinary capital of the world, what would you guess, Dan?
Oh, I have no idea.
Well, it might surprise you, it's pizza.
Hmm.
So it kind of really gives us an interestingly honest view of who we are. And then and some of the searches are also kind of give you insights into other people's cultures as well. So, for instance, I was looking around searches for how to say thank you, because obviously that's a kind of universal thing. We all say thank you for stuff. And I saw there was a trend for how to say thank you for an unexpected gift. And it was such a weirdly specific thing that I kind of went down a bit of a rabbit hole. And the top place looking for it was Niger, which is a country in Africa, of which I know nothing, apart from what's in the news. And so I thought, well, this is interesting. So I wonder why that is. So I messaged the Nigerian embassy in the US, and I didn't get a response from them. Messaged the US consulate in Niger, didn't get a response from them. But I found a scientist, a NASA hydrologist called Dr. Faji Minor, who is amazingly well qualified, worked incredibly hard to become one of the top hydrologists in the world, works for NASA. And I mailed her and said, I'm really sorry, this is not about hydrology, but could you tell me a bit about Niger and why this might be spiking? And she replied that there is a culture of giving in Niger. So if you turn up at somebody's house, even if you have nothing, you'll turn up with a gift, even if it's like an egg or something. And that was so interesting to me because it was this little trend, very ephemeral, kind of like almost a ghost in the machine that appeared and then taught me something about a country that I didn't know anything about. So the data will make you laugh. There's a sadness to it as well and a happiness to it. And it reflects who we are, I think.
To learn more, the book is What We Ask Google, A Surprisingly Hopeful History of Humankind by Simon Rogers. Simon, thank you for talking with me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.